and walking between the hills of Safa and Marwa. Pilgrims then spend a day praying in the valley of Mina before heading to Arafat, some 20 kilometers east of Mecca. They then stone three pillars in Mina in a symbolic gesture of stoning the devil the following day. After the stoning, an animal is sacrificed to mark the first day of Eid al-Adha, when Muslims commemorate the willingness of Prophet Abraham to make any sacrifice commanded to him by God. The pilgrims conclude Hajj by returning to Mecca for a final tawaf. Although not part of a Hajj itself, many people round off the pilgrimage with a visit to the holy city of Medina, where the Prophet is buried. However, this year, like the year before, Saudi officials have restricted the number of pilgrims to the holy sites.
So obviously, it's going to be a challenge because COVID is a real virus, and it's really affecting the whole world. People have died from this virus, and we've seen what happened in Iran and different countries as well as in Canada. So, to have social distance is difficult when you're doing the pilgrimage. So that is obviously a problem as well. And it does have, restrictions to how much people can maybe attend a Hajj. But at the same time, the Saudi regime is taking advantage of this, right? And they have, pulled away from letting anybody come from different countries in the world.
This year, only 60,000 vaccinated residents of the kingdom are expected to take part. In a message issued on the occasion of the Hajj pilgrimage, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said Muslim nations have been mostly subject to the aggressive Western countries' greed and interference over the past 150 years. The leader said Muslims should now make up for the past and stand firm against aggression and wickedness of the Western powers. The leader said resistance against the United States and other transgressing countries will help Muslims take their fate into their own hands. He urged Muslims to rush to the assistance of their fellows in Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other countries where the U.S. and its cohorts have been interfering for years.
The intervention in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Afghanistan, all these countries that are in the Middle East that are Islamic by nature, that the majority of people there are Muslims, the American intervention and their hands are in there, and it caused a lot of sedition, a lot of divisions, a lot of problems, and now a lot of countries are suffering economically because the resources are not being used towards liberating their lands and to be more sovereign. And we have puppets that are working in all different countries, unfortunately serving the great Satan, America.
The leader said resistance fighters are eloquently expressing their firm decision to confront every act of interference and malice on the part of the U.S. and its cohorts. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the U.S. seeks to distort the will, demands, and actions of resistance forces in the region. He stressed that such efforts stem from America's deep ignorance about awake and alert regional nations. Ayatollah Khamenei concluded that the primary result of a struggle in the way of God will be to prevent America and other international aggressors from interfering in the affairs of Islamic countries.
On July 19, 2019, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps detained the UK-flagged oil tanker Stena Impero in the Strait of Hormuz, a channel that links the Persian Gulf with the Oman Sea and the Indian Ocean. In a statement, the IRGC said the Swedish-owned vessel had been impounded with its 23 crew members aboard at the request of the Ports and Maritime Organization of Hormuzgan Province for failing to respect international maritime rules. The British tanker had violated the maritime regulations by switching off its tracking systems. It also disregarded the established procedures by making an entry from the exit point of the Strait of Hormuz in the south instead of Northern Pass. The oil tanker was then escorted to Iran's Bandar Abbas port for further legal procedures and investigations. The head of Hormuzgan Ports and Maritime Organization said Stena Impero ignored distress calls as it collided with a fishing boat on its route.
The vessel, to avoid inspections that we must have conducted in this collision incident, changed its route. This jeopardized the safety of shipping lanes in the region and gravely violated international regulation on passage in marine areas. Accordingly, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' naval forces guided the vessel to harbor at the port city of Bandar Abbas for inspection as well as technical investigation of the circumstances, effects, and causes of the incident in accordance with international regulations.
Tensions escalated between Iran and the UK following the seizure of Stena Impero. Britain described the seizure as a dangerous act and called for the release of the vessel.
We need to see the illegal seizing of a British flagged vessel reversed. We need that ship released. And we continue to be very concerned about the safety and welfare of the 23 crew members.
However, Iran said the seizure of the British vessel was legal. It said collisions happen in the Strait of Hormuz, but regulations require those involved to respond to regional authorities' inquiries. After 2 months in detention, Iran's inquiry into the tanker's conduct was completed and a resolution to the matter was reached. Stena Impero set sail in September and left Iranian waters for Dubai, putting an end to 2 months of row. In early June, British Marines assisted Gibraltar to seize an Iranian supertanker off the southern coast of Spain. Gibraltar's officials claimed the ship was transporting crude oil to Syria in violation of EU sanctions imposed on Damascus. Moreover, Britain defended the seizure of Iran's supertanker as a legal move. Meanwhile, Washington praised the move and hailed it as a sign of Europe acting along the line of U.S. unilateral sanctions against Tehran. However, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif slammed the detainment of Iran's tanker and described it as piracy, adding that the objective behind Iran's actions was to uphold international maritime rule. Also, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran would respond to Britain's piracy over the seizure of an Iranian oil tanker in Gibraltar.
So it's an unbelievable arrogance on the part of the Western powers, but then they've been demonstrating that for most of the 20th century and all of this century.
U.S. sanctions on Iran's oil, U.K. seizure of Iranian supertanker, and sabotage operations on oil ships are all instances of the West's actions that have caused turmoil in the international energy market. Add to this list the economic warfare waged by Israel against Iran. A Wall Street Journal report in March revealed that Israel had systematically struck at least 12 Iranian ships. However, Iran has time and again shown its adversaries that their illegal acts in the Persian Gulf will not be left unanswered.
The discovery of an unmarked graveyard at a former residential school run by the Catholic Church in the Canadian province of British Columbia in May, which contained at least 215 human remains, mostly young children, prompted an outpouring of grief and anger and a wider investigation into similar boarding schools that were opened from the late 19th century to the mid-1990s. The probes have so far found some 1,100 bodies at the sites of former residential schools in the provinces of British Columbia and Saskatchewan. A Canadian researcher whose works contributed to the uncovering of the first mass grave has said the discoveries so far have barely scratched the surface. The residential school system in Canada was established in 1883 under the country's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald. The aim was to assimilate Indigenous peoples in Canada and destroy their languages and culture. By the 1920s, attending residential schools had been made mandatory for children aged between 7 and 15.
These have been going on for years. The residential school survivors just basically were ignored. Now today, it seems a shock to some people, but it shouldn't be a shock because this was known that it was the policy in Canada. It was also the policy in the United States. They just pulled these kids out of their homes, and they wanted to indoctrinate them. And that's exactly what they tried to do.
some 150,000 children were separated from their parents, often under threats of persecution. The first mass grave in British Columbia was found after indigenous elders recollected the memories of young children digging holes in the ground. The survivors have told harrowing stories of how the mistreatment and abuse the children were subjected to at the former residential schools led some to attempt suicide or try to escape.
Many of our children who ran away during the winter and froze to death on their way home. And the quilts, the black robes, start lying about the children. Oh yeah, they're doing fine here. In the meantime, they were missing, and no one had searched for them.
A former student of the Cooper Island Industrial School has described the place as Canada's Alcatraz. In a 2015 report, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada called the practices employed in the former schools, quote, cultural genocide.
We're trying to say, people trying to say now, cultural genocide, as if it doesn't fit in the description of the word genocide, as defined by the United Nations. I mean, it's very clear that that's what they did.
These are the hard truths that are part of Canada's history. These are the hard truths we must confront as a society.
The Canadian government has vowed to fulfill the Indigenous people's demands to fund investigations into the graves around the country, but it's come under criticism for failing to do so earlier, as the discoveries made so far have been funded by the Indigenous groups themselves. The First Nations leaders say over 6,000 children died at the schools from causes like disease, accident, and suicide, but there's no clear picture of how many children lost their lives throughout the years. That means there will be more headlines about mass graves discoveries around Canada in the months to come.
The United Arab Emirates is among a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States and condemned by Palestinians. The Emiratis, who have been particularly open about their ongoing normalization process, opened an embassy in Israel this week.
The UAE has never been known for having an independent foreign policy. It has never stood for the rights of Palestinian people. Historically and recently, as you have seen, the UAE has always aligned its foreign policy with the foreign policy objectives of Western countries like the US and UK.
The new embassy is located in the heart of Israel's financial hub, Tel Aviv's Stock Exchange building. This is seen by many as a sign that the two sides are highlighting the role of economic cooperation in their normalization of ties. Last month, Israel opened an embassy in the Emirati capital Abu Dhabi and a consulate in the UAE's business hub Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals, ranging from financial services to tourism. Critics say Emirati leaders have totally abandoned the Palestinian cause for the economic and political dividends of ties with the Israeli regime. The controversial normalization process is very much ongoing, despite Palestinian anger. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stances adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinian movement Hamas says this week's embassy opening, quote, marks an insistence on the great sin against the people of Palestine and all the nations of the region. It warned that the move would encourage the regime to press ahead with its crimes in the occupied territories and in the besieged Gaza Strip. Observers warn that the embassy opening just weeks after Israel's deadly onslaught against the Gaza Strip and the escalation of the regime's violations in the occupied West Bank indicates that some Arab states are no longer bound by the Palestinian cause. Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel. The Palestinian issue was once a unifying cause among Arab countries. But Israel, backed by the United States, has apparently managed to divide them more than ever. Israel has been especially thankful to the United States for pushing the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan to normalize their ties with the regime. America has always been a staunch ally of Israel, but former U.S. President Donald Trump was perhaps the best friend of the Israelis in a very long time. His extremely pro-Israel decisions and policies are still impacting the lives of people in the West Asia region, especially those in Palestine. The Palestinians say they have come to the conclusion that America's heavily biased stance leaves no room for any further U.S. mediation role regarding Palestine in the future.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The close ties between incarceration and pollution seen in Detroit are replicated across the United States. A recent Grist analysis found that the nation's three largest jail systems, including Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, have facilities disproportionately located in areas where there are elevated risks for pollution-related cancer, respiratory hazards, diesel pollution exposure, and proximity to toxic wastewater and hazardous waste. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Adam Mahoney, writer. This article is published under the heading, Detroit's prison population will soon be stuck living next to a toxic site. Stay tuned for more. For three decades, Detroit Renewable Power had burned 3,000 tons of trash every day, emitting dangerous levels of nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, and lead into the atmosphere, contaminating surrounding neighborhoods. RA had spent years fighting to close the toxic site. Between 2013 and 2018, the incinerator racked up more than 750 citations for exceeding pollution emissions standards from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, or MDEQ. And according to a local environmental law center, the incinerator violated the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Clean Air Act over 100 times as well. Data from the EPA and MDEQ shows that the facility is located in one of Wayne County's worst neighborhoods for air pollution, a community that is also 76% people of color and 71% of low income. After being released, Ra and her colleagues succeeded in getting the incinerator shut down in 2019. The closure doesn't completely eliminate the environmental threat, however. Studies have shown that contaminants emitted during waste incineration have the ability to infiltrate surrounding soil and groundwater, with impacts that persist for years even after a site is closed. Now, Detroit officials say a new jail complex is needed to address safety concerns in the city's aging jails, as well as save on maintenance costs. But the city's plan to construct the Wayne County Criminal Justice Center across the street from the old Detroit renewable power incinerator will force up to 2,400 incarcerated people to live in close proximity to the facility's toxic legacy. While trash is no longer being burned on site, Detroit Renewable Power is still operating as a solid waste transfer station, taking in 1,000 tons of waste per day. Transfer waste stations are known to emit odors, cause noise, attract rodents, and cause air emissions both from unloading dry and dusty waste and increased traffic in the immediate neighborhood. Down the street from the new jail site, just beyond the recently shuttered incinerator, is a hazardous waste treatment plant known to fill the air with a rotting fish smell, which over the past 6 years has itself received more than 20 pollution violations from MDEQ, now called the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. The waste treatment plant's violations are primarily for pungent odors released into the neighborhood, but also for dust and soot emissions beyond the state limits. Local residents say the emissions often make simply being outside unbearable. The jail site is also right next to I-75, a major highway, adding another source of noise and air pollution that inmates will be exposed to. Living in Detroit has given me a deep understanding that fights against the prison system and police are also fights against poverty and pollution, Raw told GIST. The close ties between incarceration and pollution seen in Detroit are replicated across the United States. A recent GIST analysis found that the nation's three largest jail systems, including Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, have facilities disproportionately located in areas where there are elevated risks for pollution-related cancer, respiratory hazards, diesel pollution exposure, and proximity to toxic wastewater and hazardous waste. According to the EPA, those incarcerated within the new Wayne County Criminal Justice Center will be exposed to more diesel pollution and situated closer to hazardous waste than 90% of the country. The jail's location on Detroit's east side within a heavily polluted area wasn't in the original plans. The project, which first got underway in 2011, was initially slated to be built in downtown Detroit, close to public transit. But after the city ran over budget on the jail, construction paused. Officials made a deal with Dan Gilbert, co-founder of Quicken Loans, a company accused of fraudulent lending, and founder of Bedrock, a real estate business, both of which fall under Gilbert's parent company, Rock Venture, which includes over 100 other affiliated businesses. The deal was that Gilbert would receive the original downtown jail site in return for providing funding to continue the project at a new location on Detroit's east side, and that Bedrock would manage the construction of the facility. This arrangement underscores the way that environmental and criminal justice have become entangled in the new Wayne County Criminal Justice Center. It's being funded in part by a private investor, Gilbert, who has been charged with gentrifying Detroit, the blackest large city in America, and displacing residents in the process, as apartment buildings across the city were forcibly vacated for redevelopment. Never before has a private entity held so much influence in a major American city as Rock Ventures holds in Detroit. Business Insider declared in 2018, and no one in the private sector is as powerful as Gilbert. According to city officials, the jail will save taxpayers' money in the long run and is needed to improve safety for those incarcerated. The new complex will replace three existing prison facilities that are spread across the city, a setup that requires inmates to be transported from the jail to courtroom for every legal appearance. The new centralized Wayne County Jail will have a court on site so that those awaiting trial will walk to court rather than being driven. From the consolidation of the buildings and the resulting decrease in building maintenance and staffing costs, the new jail is expected to save taxpayers $10 million to $20 million annually. Environmental justice organizers argue the money could be better spent elsewhere. Instead of putting forward hundreds of millions of dollars into prisons, we should be putting hundreds of millions of dollars into schools, said Michelle Martinez, executive director of the nonprofit Michigan Environmental Justice Coalition. Detroit's public schools are notorious for environmental health hazards like periodically unsafe drinking water, as well as mold and heating and cooling issues. A new distribution utility plant will also be built to service the new jail, another $35 million the county will pay for. Detroit residents, community leaders, and environmentalists have raised concerns about the new location of the jail since its announcement, citing its proximity to a hotbed of industrial pollution, taxpayers taking on additional debt to finance the jail, and the inconvenience for visitors and criminal justice officials since the district court will still be located downtown. Despite multiple interviews, requests to the Wayne County Executive Office and Wayne County Commissioners, no one from the county was able to confirm whether or not an environmental impact statement or assessment was conducted before building the jail.
Weight of chains. Part 4.
Where is the line between these NGOs and political parties? Aren't NGOs supposed to be the corrective factor of all levels of government instead of betting on who'll get into the government? The goal of these NGOs, however, was something else.
We all gathered ourselves pretty much on the same values and same goals that we thought would be good for Serbia for more than 10 years in different settings of us knowing each other more or less. And whenever we recruit new interims or whoever, we always refer them to our website, to our manifesto, and openly say that we are in favor of Serbian NATO membership.
But it doesn't stop there. These NGOs don't wait for citizens to become legal adults in order for those NGOs to start recruiting them or shaping their opinions on various political or social issues.
We have, for example, many educational programs now 10 years, mostly secondary school children and students. So we have human rights schools which last 10 days. We gather children from all over Serbia, from different backgrounds. We select usually 30 children. In 10 days, and it's very intensive program, they really changed. In what way? They offered a framework, a referential framework to think. You just have to guide them, to tell them what is wrong and what is good, what is evil, you know. So these elementary things, just to show them direction. They easily accept it.
Yes, children do tend to get brainwashed more easily. That's why NGOs don't waste time in making it clear who are the world's good guys.
The West is almost a synonym for democracy, for the respect of human rights and the rule of law, for individual liberties.
But hey, I'm sure these NGOs can be critical towards the West as well, despite receiving money from them.
Do I think that the United States might be unfair sometimes towards someone? Somebody, yes, of course. No one is perfect.
Do you have any examples of that?
Sure. I don't know. Now I have hard times imagining the example, but maybe...
That's okay. It's not like the United States or the CIA ever admit to making mistakes either.
The United States and the CIA as one of its implements made mistakes and makes mistakes all the time.
Oh, so the former CIA director does admit that, but Ushangamsa can't think of any mistakes.
I don't know.
Talk about being more Catholic than the Pope.
Because they are technically non-governmental, whatever they do, the country that they're acting in, you can't accuse the United States of doing it because it's a non-governmental organization that is doing this subversion.
Some other countries knew how to deal with this. In 2012, Russian President Vladimir Putin approved a law which was previously cleared with overwhelming support by Parliament, obliging NGOs that received funding from abroad to register as foreign agents. The U.S. State Department quickly condemned the law, which was really odd considering that the U.S. passed a very similar law, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, back in 1938.
Today's threat to our national security is not a matter of military weapons alone. We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse, the fifth column, spies, saboteurs, and traitors. Our moral and our mental defenses must be raised up as never before against those who would cast a smokescreen across our vision.
The U.S. law requires groups representing the interests of foreign powers in a political or quasi-political capacity to disclose their relationship with the foreign government and information about related activities and finances. This law is still in effect in the U.S.
If America really is about freedom, democracy, and the rule of law, then it should be doing the same sort of thing in Saudi Arabia, but they don't. Let's have a look at the situation for women. They barely have any rights. Their rights in education is restricted. They're restricted when it comes to elections. So that just shows what Saudi Arabia is like domestically. But you could argue there's even a more sinister aspect to Saudi Arabia. It was Saudi Arabia that gave birth to Al-Qaeda, from 9/11 to Bali to Madrid to London to Damascus. The roots go all the way back to Saudi Arabia.
Wow, from what this guy's saying, Saudi Arabia sounds like a horrible place. It must be on top of America's terrorist list.
Well, they're not at all on top of America's terrorist list. Saudi Arabia is one of America's closest allies in the world because of the business links there. If the Americans were so sincere about protecting and encouraging human rights in the world and democracy, there'd be an American naval flotilla off the coast of Saudi Arabia. It's one of the most wicked regimes in the world.
The foreign-funded civil society issue had little to do with human rights, and even less with democracy. In Introducing Democracy, a book written by David Beetham and Kevin Boyle, and published by UNESCO for the education of people in newly established democracies on human rights and political freedoms, it said that an influence of an NGO on a government can be democratic only if it stems from mass membership, and not that which stems from the accumulation of wealth or power in the hands of a few. In Serbia, according to their websites or statutes, the Center for Cultural Decontamination had 14 members, the Helsinki Board for Human Rights had 9 members, the Humanitarian Law Center had 8 members, and the Center for Euro-Atlantic Studies had 4 members. As for the funding, despite these organizations practically framing the word transparency on their walls, they never were very transparent regarding how much money they received. So I did a little investigative work and sent out questionnaires to all of the sponsors of the organizations that I mentioned, asking how much money they gave to the NGOs. A few actually replied. This was just the tip of the iceberg. So much for mass membership with no accumulation of wealth. For a group of organizations supportedly promoting democracy at every corner, they weren't very democratic at all. At least by UNESCO standards. Some of the individuals working in these NGOs advocated full acceptance of everything the International Monetary Fund demands, despite the lessons from Greece, Ecuador, and many other countries.
I don't think West is enslaving us. I think West is liberating us. International Monetary Fund is liberating us. Accepting the terms of the International Monetary Fund are a step forward for Serbia.
The IMF serves the IMF. It doesn't serve any country. The IMF comes in like a vulture. It puts Serbia deeper into debt. That's what it'll do. So the people will be working for the international financial bankers.
Though compliant in the beginning, the first post-Milosevic Prime Minister of Serbia, Zoran Djindjic, eventually started realizing what the IMF, together with Mlađan Dinkić and a few other so-called experts, were doing to his country. In the last months of his life, Zoran Djindjic even attempted to sack Mlađan Dinkić from the position of governor of the Serbian National Bank, and Djindjic set up a plan to start returning Serbia's loans in 2006. This shocked many in international financial institutions and Western corridors of power. Sadly, Djindjic's plan was cut short. Zoran Djindjic was assassinated in March of 2003, and though a Serbian court convicted former paramilitary leader Milorad Ulemek Legia for the murder, the political background behind the assassination was never revealed. The next chosen prime minister, Vojislav Koštunica, continued Serbia's path towards integrations with the West. But he, too, at one point, began to think that he could reduce Serbia's debt and get away with it.
In 2007, yeah, at one point, Serbia was in the process of lowering its level of debt.
By next year, Koštunica was gone. He wasn't assassinated, but his political career was, thanks to an unprecedented political and media campaign against him. Interestingly enough, many in Serbia who admire Zoran Djindjic today mostly do so because of his motivating speeches, which were frankly very impressive. In them, Djindjic advocated a change of mentality, telling Serbs that they all had to work together in creating a better society. But they knew little about his bitterness regarding Western plans for Serbia in the last days of his life. In his very last interview, Djindjic talked about the West as he rarely did before. This interview was almost completely ignored in every documentary about the life and work of Zoran Djindjic. With both Djindjic and Koštunica out of the picture, Serbia's debt started sharply increasing. The people were confused. They were afraid. It seemed that everyone was against them and there was no way out. Then, a ray of light shined through. Another one. 10 more. 12 shining stars. The European Union.
Europe is following a parallel of the United States. It's growing bigger and bigger. The Eurozone has allowed the banks to become bigger, which is not a healthy thing for a regional world.
You do control your own currency. You can work your way out of excessive debt. Case in point is Argentina. 10 years ago, roughly, it was in a terrible economic crisis. It had followed all the rules of the neoliberal rules, the IMF, the World Bank. It was kind of a poster child, in fact. And it crashed. And what they did was essentially default on their debts. It's called restructuring. So they restructured the debts. And IMF couldn't force the country to pay it. All the economists predicted that it's going to be a hopeless disaster. For a couple of months, it was a serious problem. But then the country started growing again. Since then, it's had maybe the highest growth rate in South America.
Europe was a lovely place. Now, with this one Eurozone, Euro currency, I feel that it's like the United States. And I don't think these countries in Europe are like the states of the United States. They don't have an identity. Croatians are Croatian. Serb is a Serb. Italian and a Frenchman, a German.
All right, but I'd like to hear something from someone who actually lives in the EU.
I live in France, and dissatisfaction with the EU is growing tremendously. Even in France, because of course the situation is worse in Greece, it's worse in Spain, it's worse in Portugal, it's worse in Italy.
Yeah, but isn't it important to, you know, belong somewhere?
Well, it's always the idea that there are good standards in the EU and it will be good for the fight against corruption, etc., to adopt European standards. Well, I would say if it's good to adopt those standards, adopt the standards. I mean, if the standards are good, adopt them, European Union or not.
Ugh, that sounds like a lot of work. Can't someone else do it?
The fact is that belonging to the European Union has not been the great benefit to the existing members that it was promised.
In Greece, before 1981, before the entrance of Greece to the European Economic Community, the predecessor structure to the European Union, they were saying literally, we will eat with golden spoons.
It has not been the case because, in fact, the economic policy of all the countries is dictated by the bureaucracy.
Look what happened to Greece 30 years in the European Union. And not only this phase now with the economic crisis. We have no productive basis, no agricultural sector. We are importing everything. And the tourism which we have are not leaving really wealth to the people. This is tour operators. This is money which goes again out of the country.
Boy, this guy makes the EU sound like a Greek tragedy. Maybe the EU just doesn't like Greeks. What about the Croats? They recently joined the EU and love it. The Croatian president adores the EU. And that's because joining the EU made Croatia better.
No matter how much the Serbian government bows down to everything that the Europeans ask, they are still treated like they're doing something wrong.
No, you can't really mean that. Serbia needs the EU. It's the ray of hope, the last chance.
It seems to me rather sad that a country with the vigor, I think, intellectual and other of Serbia, for a small country, that it should pin all of its policy and hopes on getting into a club that apparently doesn't want it.
All right, fine. At least Serbia got a lot of foreign investments, right? And a small town in the south of the country was about to get a lesson in just how great foreign investments can be. Vranje had a well-developed shoe production company. Founded back in 1958, it started producing top-notch shoes, which quickly made it the leader in women's and sports shoes in Serbia, Yugoslavia, and the Balkans. The people were proud of their shoe company, and it was called Koštana, named after the title of a book written by Boris Stanković, a famous Serbian writer born in Vranje. At its height, the company employed 4,000 workers and had production facilities in several municipalities around Vranje. Unlike Sever in my hometown of Subotica, Koštana didn't survive the UN-imposed sanctions in the 1990s. It simply crashed. While some workers were old enough for retirement, many people who still could and wanted to make shoes couldn't find a job. Then a ray of hope appeared. In the 2000s, Serbian enterprising professionals in 8 factories revived shoe production in and around Vranje. The Sanj company was the largest of them, employing 552 workers, while another 68 businesses were involved in manufacturing leather products and shoes, thus employing most of the skilled workers who were left without a job when Koštana collapsed. Some companies received help from SIEPA, the Serbian Investment and Export Promotion Agency. The companies produced shoes for such European fashion brands as Nero Giardini and Moschino of Italy, as well as Louis Vuitton of France. The locals in Vranje showed that they could do good business and employ a lot of people without foreign management or investment. But then, Mlađan Dinkić had a brilliant idea. In a situation where the biggest local shoe companies had formed a cluster called Koštana, slowly reviving the glory days of the old company, here was Dinkić bringing in a foreign company, the Italian Geox, to compete with local companies. Fair enough, one might say. Some healthy competition couldn't hurt. The problem was that unlike the local companies, which received around $2,800 per worker from SIEPA, Geox received over $12,400 per worker from SIEPA. This allowed Geox to snatch up many workers from the local companies which were doing good business, and with them, snatched up the profits as well, and took them to Italy. The local shoe companies were no match for Geox, and their dream of reviving the pride that was once Koštana was fading away. The biggest foreign investment in Serbia is usually considered to be the acquisition of the Zastava car factory by Fiat. This is considered by many to be Dinkic's greatest success. However, despite the export of 117,000 vehicles worth around $2 billion, the local Fiat factory in the Serbian town of Kragujevac made just over $13 million in 2013. Since Serbia owns 33% of the factory, a little over $4 million belonged to Serbia. Considering the fact that Serbia invested $540 million into the factory, at this pace, it would take about 120 years to get back what was invested. The job is set so that everything is produced in Italy through Fiat's cooperators, while only the assembling is done in Serbia. If Serbia spends the money so that the profit goes to Italy, wouldn't it be more logical for Serbia to spend the money so that the profit stays in Serbia? What the example of Vranje showed was that locally grown industry could make it in the world market if properly stimulated. As the local companies were being foiled by their own government, unemployment started growing again. And for those who were too young to retire, but too old to find a new kind of job, it seemed that there was only one solution for their problems. Ljiljana Georgievska from UNIT, an organization that dealt with workers who lost their jobs because their companies went bankrupt following Macedonia's mismanaged privatization process. Macedonia, a former Yugoslav republic, unlike their counterparts in Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia, Serbia, and Montenegro, didn't experience wars or sanctions in the 1990s. The only armed conflict it experienced was in 2001, when Albanian separatists attempted a repeat of the Kosovo scenario. The Macedonians reacted, NATO stopped the Macedonian offensive, and a ceasefire was agreed upon, with Albanians getting many privileges but not allowed to secede. Dozens were killed in the conflicts, and it didn't affect the economy much. Oh, and the country had a very, very low suicide rate. And yet, more and more people were killing themselves in various ways. It was tough for Macedonia, and many who used to be the golden middle class looked back to Yugoslavia with nostalgia.
RIV English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIV English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIV English Radio.
The limelight.
In response to Jeff Bezos' spaceflight, Deepak Javier, Oxfam International's global head of inequality campaign, said, "We have now reached stratospheric inequality. Billionaires burning into space, away from a world of pandemic, climate change, and starvation. 11 people are likely now dying of hunger each minute, while Bezos prepares for an 11-minute personal space flight. This is human folly, not human achievement." In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading "Oxfam slams Bezos' space trip as billions suffer on Earth." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. With billionaire Jeff Bezos taking flight into space aboard an unpiloted Blue Origin rocket, the humanitarian group Oxfam International blasted the world's richest man as the avatar of a system that allows a handful of people accumulate enough wealth to flee the planet amid widespread suffering on an increasingly polluted, warming, and pandemic-ravaged Earth. We have now reached stratospheric inequality, Oxfam's Deepak Javier said in a statement recently. Billionaires burning into space away from a world of pandemic, climate change, and starvation. Javier pointed to a recent Oxfam report showing that 11 people on Earth are dying of hunger every minute, just one example of the needless hardship that billions are experiencing as Bezos embarks on his joyride into space, which he hopes will set the stage for a profitable tourism business that caters to the whims of the rich. Ultra-rich are being propped up by unfair tax systems and pitiful labor protections, said Javier. Bezos pays next to no U.S. income tax but can spend $7.5 billion on his own aerospace adventure. Bezos' fortune has almost doubled during the COVID-19 pandemic. He could afford to pay for everyone on Earth to be vaccinated against COVID-19 and still be richer than he was when the pandemic began. What we need, Javier added, is a fair tax system that allows more investment into ending hunger and poverty, into education and healthcare, and into saving the planet from the growing climate crisis, rather than leaving it. Bezos' flight comes after fellow billionaire Richard Branson journeyed to the edge of space in what the Virgin Group founder hopes will be the start of a series of commercial space flights for those who can cover the high cost of a ticket. About 2 million people can afford to go to space, according to equity analysts at Vertical Research Partners, with that high net wealth population growing at around 6% each year. The Wall Street Journal reported recently. It estimates that Virgin needs to transport around 1,700 or about 0.8% of those individuals to space each year for its model to work. Virgin Galactic says it has collected around $80 million in sales and deposits by selling tickets at roughly $250,000 a clip. Among the early customers is billionaire SpaceX founder Elon Musk, whose wealth has grown by more than $138 billion during the pandemic. Blue Origin, for its part, is reportedly planning to charge upwards of $300,000 per seat for future 11-minute flights, which will feature several minutes of weightlessness just past the edge of space. Class warfare is Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Richard Branson becoming $250 billion richer during the pandemic, paying a lower tax rate than a nurse, and racing to outer space while the planet burns and millions go without healthcare, housing, and food, tweeted Warren Gunnels, staff director for Senator Bernie Sanders. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Saving Capitalism, directed by Jacob Kornbluth. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, Saving Capitalism is a documentary that explores the reasons why the economic system that once made the US strong is suddenly failing. The film is a clear-eyed examination of a political and economic status quo that no longer serves the people, exposing the powerful alliances between Washington and Wall Street, as well as the extreme wealth disparity in the US. And starring Robert Reich, and whose book inspired the film, served as Labor Secretary under President Bill Clinton, takes us through the US's fragile democracy and its fight for survival, and argues that it's up to ordinary US citizens to change the rules.
There's a huge amount of anger and frustration. So many people desperately wanting to be heard. And nobody is listening. It's up to us to change the rules.
We are a two-tiered society composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind.
And it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Thank you very much. Robert Reich, former Labor Secretary under President Clinton.
I want to go to places where I could actually interact.
I really want to talk to people about their lives. Yes, that's true. As income and wealth go to the top, so does political power.
Money! People don't trust that our society is working for most people. Nobody in our society, the richest nation in the history of the world, should be working and not making it.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, something's way off all over the country. Right, left, everybody. Something's wrong.
This is about power. It's about reclaiming our democracy and reclaiming our economy.
This country is upside down, and it's not working for 99% of our society anymore.
We are at a critical turning point in this country, and this is dangerous. The only way forward is to get organized and politically active. New York now! New York now! Democracy is a very fragile thing.
It's now up to the next generation.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So I found this film an enlightening watch, and I think it offers an effective crash course on US inequality, particularly on the economy. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
It's a really easy film to watch. It's made in a kind of gentle, smoothly edited, it carries you along, it's intriguing, it's gripping. And Robert Reich is a really great central character. He's kind of warm and a little bit scruffy and impish and funny.
Very entertaining to watch.
He's very entertaining, and the things he says are incredibly pointed and they grab your attention. The central topic of the film is really strong. I don't know, I mean, the title is a little bit, I think, misleading almost, because I think it will put off a lot of viewers. But the central idea of the fact that, you know, the economic system in America is tilted so heavily toward corporations is a really important message that I think needs to get out there. And so you're watching it, you feel your blood starting to boil. It's one of those documentaries that starts making you more and more angry, even as it kind of gives you some ideas of the way forward or what's likely to happen.
And Clive, if I could turn to you, as a political economist, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
My first reaction was that it was something of a political pitch. And it was very articulate, very well done. It articulated the symptoms extremely well. Whether Reich's prescription for the remedy is appropriate, I would question, because it's the pendulum swinging back and forth. And Reich emerged in the 60s and 70s, and he seems to hark back to that as some sort of golden era, but that was just a temporary blip post-war. in this long war of attrition, which is effectively what they managed in the 60s and 70s, both in the UK and in the US, was some sort of social contract, which was a renegotiation of the terms of slavery. Yeah. But slavery certainly was.